Hello once again. What's up, everybody? Thank you so much for joining us. I am Mark Becker, your host this week, as every week. I'm really honored to have this guest here. If you listen to the show, you're probably a pretty well-informed person. If you are a well-informed person, you know who this guy is. If you don't, well, you will, and I promise you're going to leave the show thinking the same thing I do. Man, this dude is really smart. My guest today, nationally renowned political consultant and commentator. He writes for, well, everybody, but the Bulwark Rolling Stone, host of the Bulwark podcast, contributor to Crooked Media. Yes, the Pod Save America guys. Speaking of them, he appears on as a frequent guest, political consultant to numerous national campaigns, a brilliant writer. Speaking of that, he authored a New York Times bestseller. If you're watching on the video, I got my my copy here. They have good product placement. Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. All around wonderful guy, my friend Tim Miller. What's up, buddy?
Yeah, Mark All right. Becker.
All
bro.
Around good guy, Tim Miller. You're here in the flesh. It's
too
really
kind
you.
Of an intro.
Thank
yeah,
you.
It's really me. Hell yeah, Wisconsin. Let's do this.
This is a big. It's a big state. You know, this is going to be that whole blue wall thing. So the show is the show is broadcast on 20 different stations all across the state. So your voice is traveling the fruited plains.
Well, hello, Wisconsin.
Of cheese curds and Packer country. So it's awesome to have you. How's book sales? New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, you know, I sold kind of a lot of books. I'm grateful that people read it. And, you know, it was I wrote it during the pandemic and I was finishing it during, I was at my husband's in home in West Virginia, and the only place I could get peace was in his childhood bedroom. And so kind of like going back through the trauma of all the bad decisions that you made as a Republican operative while sitting in your husband's childhood bed is like, you know, it's something God. I had to deal with my therapist for a little while, but I think it turned out all right.
I would imagine, you know, because my bookmark is there, so I haven't gotten through all of it yet, but it is interesting. And I would imagine there is some of that cathartic, like, oh man, you know. As you're writing this, I had Charlie Sykes on. He was patient zero. Charlie Sykes he was the first guest. And I asked him, you know, are you the same person? He's like, no, really, I'm not. As he was when he was on the air.
In a good way, though. A lot of growth. Yes. I think Charlie's grown. I've grown. And yeah, I try. In the book, look, I had a lot of people come to me. They want me to write this book, these publishers, that was like a burn book. If you ever seen Mean Girls, I'm just like, here are all these terrible Republicans.
Yes.
And I was like, okay. I said, basically, I'll do a burn book, but I'll do a half a burn book. Yes. In the first half, I'll burn myself. And I feel like that way I will at least, you know, feel like I can do it with integrity if I like look inward for a while. And then once I feel like I've fully, you know, gone to confession as a Catholic boy, then I can turn my fire on all the people who still need to go to confession. So that's what I tried to do with it. And I've changed. The party's changed. And, the country's changed in a lot of ways. Some good, some not as good.
You grew up with that good old-fashioned Catholic guilt too, eh?
I did, man. I did. It just hangs over me.
Dude, yeah. PTSD. Now, you've recently moved. You're in the Crescent City. No.
Yeah, I'm in New Orleans now. I'm in New Orleans. It's nice, man. Being in a blue dot in a red state is, I think, a very healthy balance, you know? Sometimes those blue cities and blue states, it's a little crazy stuff going on a little bit sometimes. And, I think that New Orleans is amazing. The food here is great. Everybody's so welcoming to us, to my little family. My daughter's in kindergarten, going to go to first grade. And everybody's been super welcoming. And Carville's down here, so I get to have lunch with him from time to time. And it's been a good move for us. And New Orleans also just is so vibrant. And for me, I'm just in the I'm in the SHIT. I don't know if I can cuss on this radio show. I'm in it all day. You know, I'm like up early. I'm reading everything. I'm on the podcast. I'm on MSNBC. People calling me for advice. Like, I'm just doing stuff all day. And so like when it's over, when I step away from it, I want to talk to somebody about like LSU football or gumbo or whatever.
Denver,
you know,
and Nuggets
a good
basketball.
City for that. Yeah. Or Nuggets basketball. I'm a Nuggets head. I'm from Denver, but New Orleans has been a good move for us.
Yeah. And so I was going to ask you about that. I might as well do it now. But like, what do you do every day? I mean, I would imagine with all of your experience, you've got to have people asking for advice. And I mean, this is the circus time right now.
Yeah. Well, luckily, I made a decision after 2020 to like retire from paid political consulting, which means I can give free political advice. So people call and I give free advice all the time, but I'm focused mostly on the Bulwark. You know, I think a nice thing about it is, so I had the daily podcast, the Bulwark podcast that Charlie used to do that I've taken over from him. And I just, I could just say whatever I think, you know, I don't have to worry, oh, is a client going to get mad at me or whatever. I tell people what I think. It got, you know, so at when Joe Biden was really struggling after the debate, I think I was a lot more free than some, you know, people on the left to just say, be honest about how bad it was, be honest about how troubling it was that he was not up for this job anymore. And so I think that being a former Republican and not, you know, not just switching sides to become a Democratic strategist, being a former Republican that's a free agent gives me, I think, a little more clarity than some other people that you see on the news who are good people, but who have their eye on something else. You know, it's hard to be totally honest when you're like, oh, well, maybe that politician might want to hire me later. Nobody's going to hire me anymore. I've written a burn book about all the Republicans and my baggage is too extensive for a Democrat to ever hire me. So I'm free to just, you know, speak my mind.
No, that's great. It's a beautiful place to be. And I kind of, you know, on a much, obviously much, much smaller scale, you know, I kind of did that too. And it's a beautiful thing to be able to, you know, focus on not necessarily who's going to hire you or what your next move is, but like, let's just do what's right and work for people and fight for people who are interested in doing the same. It's a cool place to be.
Yeah, it's good for your soul.
You know, it
Candor
is.
And refreshing.
Yeah, so is the crawfish boil and gumbo and Cafe Du Monde, you know?
Yeah, I ate a man much larger than me's portion of crawfish this spring.
Dude,
I was just sucking crawfish heads all spring. It was my first spring down here. I was like, I'm the crawfish season. I was getting in it.
It's got to be interesting, like you say, to be the blue dot in a red state. You know, regionally, how is that? You know, Louisiana is typically a pretty red area, you know.
Well, we got a new governor who might be the worst governor in the country. So there are things to worry about. I feel worried. Yeah, Jeff Landry's a really bad governor.
Yep.
So they had a conservative Democrat that I really liked, John Bel Edwards, who was really my cup of tea, kind of a free market, cultural moderate Democrat, but also, you know, cared about working people and was, you know, in touch with the South. He was a great governor. And then he got term limited out. Jeff Landry came in, far right, culture warrior, on Fox all the time. And, you know, he's doing a lot of stuff that I feel worried for kids. If you're a kid growing up in Shreveport, and you know, you're trying to deal with your sexuality, you're in a mixed race family, stuff that we know about, Mark, you and I know about. It's like, I think that there's a lot of potential burdens on them right now in what's going on in the schools and having just kind of these MAGA extremists trying to take over the curriculum from families. Like they say it's parents' rights, but it's not. It's like, it's just there. It's them imposing their beliefs on everybody. And I'm concerned about that, but like in New Orleans, you know, I'm just lucky enough to not have to deal with that, right? Yeah. Like we get to choose where we live. We get to choose what school she can go to, you know, and are the community so welcoming? We haven't dealt with anything that I have to worry about besides, I guess, hurricane prep.
Yeah, there's that little thing.
Yeah.
Now you're the governor of Louisiana. He did that 10 commandments thing, right?
The 10 commandments. Yeah. He's done a version of the Don't Say Gay bill.
Yeah.
Nice guy. Targeted trans folks pretty aggressively. He sucks.
And what the first thing I really want to get into is how did we get here? You were in it on such a deep level and a high level. You know, when did you start seeing those cracks in the foundation?
Yeah. You know, I saw it for a while. I think I rationalized what I get to a lot in the book was, look, you know, at the presidential level, you know, say what you want about George Bush, catastrophic mistakes on foreign policy.
Really good person.
A well-intentioned person.
Oh,
and the compassionate conservative thing came from an earnest place. John McCain, good person, Mitt Romney. And so that was my formative time, right?
Statesman.
And so,
statesman.
And so every time I saw this, what Charlie would call recessive gene, every time I saw this stuff that grossed me out, bubbling it up, whether it be Palin or the Tea Party, or even at local levels. I'm sure you saw this in Wisconsin. A lot of times I would work for the more moderate candidate, and there would be a Trumpish type candidate or a Ted Cruz-ish candidate. Somebody's either kind of a populist, a demagogic candidate, or like a very extreme Christian conservative. And most of the time, the more mainstream candidate would win, at least in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but you're like, okay, there are people out there that are looking for this more extreme stuff. And every time I saw that, you know, kind of move that direction, I kind of rationalized it. And I was like, well, but look at the top level. At the top, you know, adults are still in charge, so to speak.
Right.
And, you know, the adults were in charge till they weren't. And I think the adults made a lot of mistakes trying to appease the more extreme elements of the base. You know, we call it throwing red meat at the base is what we called it. You know, we'd pretend like we were upset about a mosque at Ground Zero, or you'd pretend like you're mad about whatever the culture war du jour thing was. And I think that phoniness, the voters sensed it. And I think that we are not responsive to some of the voters' legitimate concerns in the Republican Party. I think that there were some legitimate concerns about the wars, about immigration. You know, there are some illegitimate concerns about immigration, but there are also some legitimate concerns that were dismissed by the Republican Party leaders. And I think and then Trump comes in and it just created this toxic stew where there was distrust between the voters and the leadership. And there was like a demand for something different, and Trump offered it to them in kind of the worst way imaginable. And I think, you know, maybe had you gone back and had a more genuine populist, you know, that did not traffic in this kind of bigotry, maybe we could be in a better place now, but we're not. And so I think that to me is kind of how I diagnose how we got here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in the next segment here, we got coming up, I want to talk a little bit about that as well. Yeah, you know, I talked to Reed Ribble was on the show, and he said, you know, because I asked him the same question, and he thinks, you know, my thought was it was really the Tea Party, and Reed blames talk radio, and so I want to get into that. And
is Reed Ribble for Kamala? Does he have a position yet?
I don't know.
I'm interviewing you now.
I'll have to ask him because I don't know. He will never endorse Trump.
Yeah.
Right. You know,
so good man. Good
He's a wonderful man, and we're so happy to have him here. But you know, he had a really unique perspective as well that we'll talk about a little later on here, on the other side. So we're sitting down with Tim Miller, author of Why We Did It. Get the book here. We got a link on our website, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Rational Revolution. I'm Mark Becker. We're talking with nationally renowned, all-around good guy, political commentator, my friend Tim Miller, author of Why We Did It. Get the book. We've got a link on all of our socials, website, all that stuff. It's a really, really fascinating deep dive on how we got on this conversation. You know, we were talking about on the other side where this came from. I remember my first like big time political rally was at the Resch Center here in Green Bay when John McCain, I think it was just a couple days after he named Sarah Palin as his running mate. And, you know, he came in and she did her speech, and it was almost like George W. Bush at the inauguration, where he's like, man, that was some crazy, you know? Yeah. You know? And so for me, and I was just getting into the political game, and seeing, you know, where we are now, going back, where did it come from? Boy, that Tea Party was a problem.
Yeah. I think that, again, the McCain-Palin thing demonstrates that this was not a monocausal thing, right? There are two things happening at the same time. There are multiple things, but there are two things in particular that can be highlighted by the McCain-Palin pick. Firstly, there was a bottom-up demand from voters, from conservative voters, that wanted new outsider leadership were not happy with the wars, were not happy with the neocon foreign policy, were not happy with, you know, kind of the more moderate social views, and they wanted somebody that was more of a fighter, more in line with them. And so, you know, the Palins and then Trump eventually gave them what they were asking for. Then there's a top-down failure of responsible leaders to kind of do you know, what leaders should do. And John McCain, great man, was totally irresponsible in choosing Sarah Palin. And I think that had the more mainstream Republican leadership, like, listened to the voters more about their legitimate concerns and done a better job addressing them, maybe they wouldn't have turned to the more demagogic politicians. Maybe they would have. I don't know. We will never know. But I think that the Palin thing kind of encapsulates both, like, that failure of leadership combined with, like, this, you know, populist demand for something a little more vulgar.
Whose idea was that? Was the Palin pick?
Steve Schmidt.
Was it? Was it really? No way.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
I get into it a little bit in the book.
Okay.
Yeah. Look, Mark Salter is his longtime speechwriter.
Good man. Brilliant guy.
Was involved and was pushing for Pawlenty.
Yes.
Schmidt was pushing for Palin. Pawlenty was the governor of Minnesota at the time, the neighboring state for people who don't remember. and McCain wanted Lieberman.
Yes.
McCain wanted to do a unity ticket.
That would have been crazy.
And basically the a lot of folks around him said he can't do a unity ticket because Lieberman's pro-choice and there'll be a revolt at the convention.
Oh yeah.
And so then Pawlenty, I think, felt a little bit milquetoast, already losing. They wanted to shake up the race, and Schmidt was making the case for Palin. Now Schmidt will blame other people and say that the vetting team didn't give him all the info.
Yeah.
And maybe that's fair. Yeah. Maybe that's fair. But that's basically what happened.
Okay. And so, you know, to read Ribble's point about talk radio. Now, obviously, with Rush, the elephant in the room, no pun intended, you know, we got Hannity and Gingrich as a frequent. How did that get such in the gutter? I mean, you know, Reid said, what was it, the fairness doctrine? Is that what that was? Or whatever, you know, really allowed Rush to get that notoriety, and it just exploded in the early 90s. I mean, talk about the damage that has done.
Yeah, the talk radio is part of it. I think that where we are now, the biggest problem that we have, maybe not the biggest, one of the biggest problems that we have in our culture, in our polarized times, is that people now totally cocoon themselves in a comfortable bubble of information where they are radicalized, where they're told everything they think is true, where they're never challenged. And the talk radio was the beginning of this, right?
Yeah.
But even back in the 90s, you know, somebody in Wisconsin, I don't want to pick on poor Charlie, but somebody could listen to Charlie, listen to Rush, listen to Mark Levin. But then at nighttime, they'd watch the local Green Bay News. They'd watch Tom Brokaw, you know, and so they're at least getting a mixture of views and information. And so what I think really happened that got us to where we are, and the talk radio guys were an early, you know, move towards this direction, was you get into the 2000s, you get to the lead up to Trump, and people now, they're listening to Rush, they're listening to Hannity, whoever, they're on social media, they're reading Breitbart, they're on their Facebook feed, they've got like random conservative influencers, Ben Shapiro, Charlie Carr, that they're following, and they're not getting any other news. They're watching at nighttime, they're watching Tucker or Laura, and so between talk radio and Fox and social media, it's created this news environment where people are becoming really more and more extreme, being made more and more extreme by the news that they consume. And I don't know how to fix that, but and I think the talk radio was one example of it. But you know, it's one of those things, balance in all things. It's kind of fine when it was just one part of your meal, but when it's the whole meal, like, that's a problem.
It's interesting because a few weeks ago I had a guy, Paul Page, who was the voice of like the Indianapolis 500, because I love racing and all that. And there was a series called Kart, and that went bankrupt, and it was all, but it was like Formula One in America. And I said, well, why did that go away? And he said, well, because people had options, you know, instead of, you know, Kart being the only game in town, you could watch football or you could watch. And so I guess that slate of options that a la carte is also the same thing that, you know, kind of doomed, you know, our political, you know, candor and all of that. So all this boils over into Trump. But I think, you know, the dirty little secret is most people in the GOP leadership, they can't stand the guy and they know he's bad, but they don't do anything about it. Like, why?
Yeah, self-preservation. This is where you do have to give the Democrats credit for actually having the courage to stand up to Biden over the last month and take some risk. Obviously the situations are different in a lot of ways, but just the one way in which they're the same is that, you know, it was risky to speak out and say something that there's something wrong with your side. And because, you know, you have the most active members of your coalition get mad. And a lot of these Democratic politicians like Adam Schiff or others who spoke out, like took a lot of heat from the activists who were like, you know, you're helping Trump or whatever. So there's this inverse thing on the other side where these guys, their voters like Trump. And so if they speak out, you know, then they're risking their political career. And you've seen this time and again. And I, you know, I think that there are people that have done this courageously, like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. And then there are people like you're in your state, like Mike Gallagher, who have done this in the most cowardly way possible, which is rather than speaking out about what they know to be true about the threat of Trump, they just walk away. They just retire. Paul Ryan, maybe a little bit of a hybrid between the Gallagher and the Liz Cheney, you know, where he is at least speaking out sometimes to his credit, but maybe not giving his full view to so as to not jeopardize his position on the Fox board. So that's what this is, man. It's all short term careerist, you know, protecting yourself and not wanting to become irrelevant and not wanting to get thrust out into the wilderness. And it's led to a lot of really damaging results. I mean, we didn't have to be here. Had 17 Republicans voted to convict Donald Trump after the insurrection, you know, the nominee of the party would probably be Ron DeSantis or whatever, Nikki Haley or somebody else who would have run.
Right. We're talking with Tim Miller here. Great conversation. We're going to talk about here where the race sits now. We're going to talk about his book. We're going to talk about all sorts of stuff here on the last segment with Tim. Coming on up. We'll see you in a little bit. What's up, everybody? Thank you for coming here, listening and hanging out with us here again this week. Mark Becker, we're talking with Tim Miller. We're talking about, you know, where the Republicans are and kind of the state of play here. And we're kind of up to 2020. And in 2020, you were on the Jeb Bush campaign. You're famously hip checked by Corey Lewandowski. good, clean fun. But then, you know, you kind of immediately were one of the absolute like founding members of this Never Trump movement. You know, you worked for our principals PAC, but then Trump was elected. And, you know, we were all kind of horrified day in and day out by the new lows and things that happened. I think your finest work, maybe other than your book, was you were a co-founder of the Republican Voters Against Trump. It was an honor. I think I recorded two testimonials. If you don't know what that is, it was a movement of former Republicans or current Republicans that kind of gave people a permission slip to say, you know what, I do not subscribe to this. And it was really an inspirational thing to do. You know, there was the Hot Joe Summer that we talked about, which was awesome. But you know, You talked a little bit about the differences between the Republicans and the Democrats. And the Democrats, like you say, to their credit, they did the right thing here. I was we were driving to Milwaukee to the airport, and we were listening to the debate, and my wife and I were both horrified, like, what is happening? Mm-hmm. And I mean, immediately the blowback was strong. And it was interesting to see how some people on one side were like, no, he's our nominee. And the other ones are like, who are we kidding?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I would imagine it was a little bit of vindication for you when he did step aside.
Yeah. I felt vindicated. I was crazy. I was having a little bit of PTSD again from that 2016 period you talked about. Because to me, in both situations, I was like, all I'm saying is the most obvious thing imaginable.
Right.
In 2016, I was like, this guy, Donald Trump, who wants to ban all Muslims and who was a reality TV show host that went bankrupt a bunch of times and started a fraudulent university, like, shouldn't be the president. Like, I thought that seemed very obvious in 2016. I was like, we have a lot of candidates. If you don't want Jeb, that's fine. Marco seems fine. There are plenty. Scott Walker hasn't turned out so great, but at the time he seemed fine. Like, there were plenty of options, okay? Mm-hmm. And so to me, I thought that seemed obvious when I was doing the anti-Trump outreach in 2016, but I took an insane amount of heat for that, of course, and kind of had derailed my career in a good way. And then this time I felt like, obviously the situations are different, but this feeling was the same, where I was like, yeah, Biden can't do it. This was it was not just a bad debate. Like, people were like, oh, it was kind of like the Romney Obama debate in 12. I was like, no, it wasn't. It was he couldn't talk. Yeah, he couldn't talk. It was horrific. And it's scary how incapable he was of doing this basic task of a campaign. And again, there were many people on social media and publicly who were ripping me and saying I was a secret Republican and this was a plant and I was trying to hurt Joe Biden. And I'm like, I'm just saying the obvious truth. So in a lot of ways, I guess it's vindication. It's a good reminder in life to just sort of stay what is true and let the chips fall where they may. It's gone. The transition to Kamala has gone about as good as expected for anybody that is in the anti-Trump side of things.
Yeah. And I think I said last week on the show that I Joe Biden's speech was, you know, it was almost like his closing speech in his presidency, but it was, I really believe that what he said will be in some sort of history books for meeting the moment, the significance of what he said. Passing the torch to the new generation, all that stuff. You know, it really was great. And like you say, the ads and everything coming out of the Harris campaign have been brilliant. And also, you know, we were coming off a really, we had some good stuff from the Trump campaign this week where he managed to insult pet owners, people without kids, biracial people. And then, the gem of a quote where he said Vice President Kamala Harris, quote, turned black in front of the, Black Journalists Association, like, good stuff, man.
It's been quite a 2 weeks. The whole nature of the campaign has changed. It's been a crazy 2 weeks in politics, and I don't know. I think back to some of the other campaigns I did, and was like, man, we thought that was crazy. We hadn't seen nothing yet.
How would this compare to anything that you've ever done?
It's like the last month has been, I think, the most insane thing in politics since. This early 70s or the 60s. I had nothing in my career. I guess, 9/11 obviously was very jarring, but that wasn't really politics. Yeah. That was a national security moment. Just the series of events from in July. Well, yeah. I guess if you go back to just the last week of June, there's the horrific debate, the worst debate I've ever seen. Then Trump gets immunity from the Supreme Court. These weeks of people speaking out, pressuring Joe Biden to step aside, which was totally unprecedented.
Yep.
Then the assassination attempt. Then Trump, with the Trump image of him standing, and then the Trump convention where he is talking about how he was almost assassinated, and then Biden does step aside, and then there's a new candidate, and now the Trump team there has not been anything like this in my career. It's been, it's been interesting to watch. I think it's a good reminder in life. Sometimes one of my lodestars for life is to fight against inertia. Mm. There's this tendency in life or in work to think that, okay, well, we're on this path. Like, let's keep going on this path. Like, let's not have any creative thinking about how we can change course, right? Like, we're on this path, we're stuck on it. It's a fait accompli. And I think we've seen, in the last 2 weeks from the Biden campaign that no, things aren't inevitable. Like, you can change course, and the results, we won't know until November, but, all signs point to just a much more optimistic future. Than the course that we were on.
How does she win this race?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in your take on that. I think Wisconsin is probably her toughest. It's interesting. Wisconsin was probably of the swing states the one Biden was doing the best in, and I think it might be the toughest for her, demographically speaking. But I think that Michigan, with Gretchen Whitmer, and Pennsylvania with Josh Shapiro and Kamala Harris, kind of a young, dynamic ticket. I don't know if she picks either of them, but either way, they'll be on the campaign trail.
I hope it's Pete. Yeah, it's not gonna be Pete. I hope it is.
Yeah, or Pete. Yeah. So, and then I think that you can. Then you got to win one other state. Like if you win Michigan and Pennsylvania, you just got to win one of the other swing states. I think she puts Georgia back in play.
Yeah.
You know, I think that Arizona potentially in play, Wisconsin in play. So I think the map is a lot more open for her. She is going to consolidate a lot of the groups that I think were in the Democratic coalition that were frustrated with Biden, young voters, black voters. And the question is, can she win our people? Mark, I think that she's going to got to do a lot of work to go out there and reassure the kind of former Republicans or the swing voting Republicans, the types of people that maybe, you know, voted for a Republican at a lower ticket in 2020, but Biden, you know, in you know, the Gallagher Biden voter in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's going to be a tough voter for her, and she's going to have to work hard to keep them.
Well,
I
asked Tammy Baldwin that. She was here, and I asked, you know, it was actually really brilliant, because I said, and this was before Biden stepped down, and I was like, you know, normally the rising tide lifts all ships, and that's the top of the ticket. But Tammy said, you know what we have this year? Number one, we have Tammy Baldwin, and she's incredibly popular in Wisconsin. Yeah. But number two, we have new maps. We have new legislative maps. And so Tammy said, I think that it will bubble up from the bottom up, because people are going to be so enthused about, oh my God, hey, we have representative democracy here in Wisconsin, something we haven't had since, you know, 2008.
Right.
And so she said, there's a lot of people that they're seeing that are enthused and excited, because their vote counts this year. So that's an interesting, and I, you know.
Yeah, I have a friend that does Run for Something, which is a great group about that encourages people to run, who has been making the same argument. I don't know. I think that the enthusiasm issue has been resolved for the Democrats. I think that they're very enthused now with a new ticket. And so persuasion is probably going to be more important at this point. Enthusiasm, when you were talking to Tammy, was a huge problem. And I think that between, you know, what you're talking about combined with the new ticket, I think that the Democratic side, and combined with the threat of, you know, Roe and all the issues surrounding abortion, you know, I think that the Democratic side is going to be.
How important is the running mate this year?
I don't, it's not nothing. You know, sometimes it's nothing. I think it's modestly important. A lot of people don't know a lot about Kamala Harris yet. And so it's kind of the first big decision that they'll see her make in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that she kind of sends a signal to voters about like what kind of president she's going to be with this pick. You know, is it a governing partner? Is it somebody a little more moderate? Is it somebody with a little more experience in foreign policy? You know, and you could go a couple different ways with it, but I think I think it's important for that. I don't think any of the names out there that I've seen could harm her. I think that there are a couple people out there that I'm just a little meh on. The governor of Kentucky, I think it doesn't do a lot for her, for example. I think he's just fine, but I don't think he's not Sarah Palin. He's not JD Vance. He's not one of these terrible picks.
No.
You know, I think that potentially it could boost her, and potentially it could be kind of a nothing burger.
You know, what a thing that's, I think, is interesting as we're talking about New York Times best-selling author Tim Miller. You know, what are the polls going to look like? What are they looking like now? I mean, is it enough time where it's accurate enough to even?
Yeah, I mean, look, the polls are moving her direction. I'm just as we speak, I'm just looking down at a text I just received for the new Nate Silver model. It's a all caps headline. It's a toss up now.
No way.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that look, like I said, the Biden was in a deep hole.
Yeah.
But a lot of that hole was people that were traditionally Democrats. It was young people mad about Gaza.
Yeah.
It was working class black and brown voters upset about inflation. And it was a wide variety of people that thought he was too old. Like, and Kamala has just solved that. All those issues, maybe not every single person, but a big, like all 80% of those people who are traditionally Democrats that had issues with Biden are now back in the fold. So that in itself, you know, makes this a toss-up race.
I mean, because with Biden, it was like a razor thin. Like he couldn't afford to lose any one of those states or his toast.
Yeah. Right. And he narrowly won last time and he had lost a bunch of people. And so now I think we're basically back to a toss up race. I mean, as Nate says, I think that's probably right. I think that she has more room to grow potentially, though, you know, depending on the VP choice, depending on what the convention looks like. And a lot of times polls are a little bit of a lagging indicator. Yeah. And also depending on momentum energy. I mean, like, this thing could flip on turnout. Like again, in the moment after the assassination attempt, wow, yeah. MAGA is going to be so pumped.
Oh, yeah.
And the Democrats are so beaten down.
Yeah.
And now you can kind of see the inverse of that happening, where Democrats are super enthused and where MAGA's enthused, but where there's the Nikki Haley type Republicans look at it and they're like, eh, maybe I'll just sit this one out, you know, and that's fine. That's how that would help her. Right. Right. And so I think that conceivably you can see the polls continue to move her direction. But it's not, look, we're a 52-48 country.
Yeah.
You know, like we're not going to wake up in 2 weeks and she's going to be up by 10. Like that's just not where the country is.
No. And I think it's interesting too. And, you know, if I were advising Trump, you know, I there's no way I would have him debate Kamala Harris. He'll eat her alive. Yeah, she'll eat him alive. It'll be a bloodbath, which I'm really looking forward to. To be honest,
yeah, I think he's in a tough spot on that.
He is.
I think he has to debate her. Like, you just look so weak if you duck her.
Right, and he said yesterday he probably would.
Yeah, if you can do the thing where, like, oh, it's unfair, they change candidates and
right. moving the goalposts.
But the only people that care about that are political obsessives. Right. Like normally, normies will be like, wait a minute, you're not going to debate her. Like,
right.
I just think that's just a huge sign of weakness. I think he's got a debater. And I think that, yeah, she'll be in, well, I think she'll benefit from a lot of things. That debate, including the facts, will be on her side in many of the subjects.
I got 15 seconds. I want you to talk about your book, please, a little bit for us.
No, it's beautiful. I looked back at the period between when I started my career, which is essentially McCain, Palin, through 2016, and talked about the root causes of why we got to MAGA. And then I did the second half is about, you know, the period from MAGA to now, talking about why I think people that knew better went along with it.
Awesome. So. It's such an honor to have you, Tim. Thank you so much for your time. And hey, we'll touch base hopefully soon before the election. And but thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Tim Miller on the Rational Revolution.
Look forward, brother. Look, thanks, brother. Appreciate it very much.
You got it. Thank you. Rational Revolution. We're here. So am I, Mark Becker, your host. My thanks to Tim Miller for hanging out with us. You know, we had some technical difficulties there. Tim was so patient and good with his time. He's so busy and he's just a wonderful, wonderful person. And I normally have kind of started to do a little like post-log button up here of the show. That's at the request of Todd, the producer, who's been great. But with Tim there, I don't think there's anything more that I can say. He's so brilliant. And so, you know, give that a listen and share it with your friends. And if you liked it, we got more of where that came from. But I want to pivot a little bit to something that's been kind of going on. Tim and I talked about this type of thing. And that's, you know, where politics and really ugly politics is getting into different places of our lives. And it's getting into our schools. And back to school is here. And, you know, it's always given me such anxiety, this back to school thing. Because when I was young, you know, I'm 37, but I still get like sweats, I get anxious, PTSD, post-traumatic school disorder. Yeah. And, you know, but it's something that I always struggled with. But then also, you know, as an adult now, back to school is like marks a solemn passage of time. And my kids get older, and no matter how hard I try to hang on to that, I can't stop that passage of time. But when I was a kid, I had ADD. You probably can't tell, you know, how I am here on the radio. But school was never easy for me. And I've really only started to like now talk about it. I really struggled, and I struggled and struggled. When I struggled, it was hopeless. When I felt hopeless, doctors medicated me. The medication wasn't always right. And just going through that, those years of of trying different things and struggling and everything. It was hard. It was really hard. And we've come a long way from, you know, understanding kids' needs and how to protect kids and who need help. And one of the ways that we do that now is through Title IX. And that brings me to kind of something that's going on in my school kids' district and districts across the United States, where this Title IX has recently been amended. And of course, it's not become something that's a routine, hey, we're going to pass this and move on and we're going to approve Title IX procedures and all of that. It's become a hot button, a political football, and it's wrong. And in Pulaski here, that's what it's become. And one thing, and I am going to hammer on a couple people pretty hard, but the leadership that we have in the school district from the administration on down, the school board president is a wonderful person. I have all sorts of respect for her. But the board, we do have a couple, you know, stereotypical backwoods type thinking. One of the members of the board got her notoriety because she was loudly opposing Pulaski bringing a Quick Trip to its main drag because that would be a hotbed of sex trafficking, of course, you know. And it didn't bring sex trafficking. What Quick Trip brought was delicious chicken and gas and, you know. so it's that type of like old school mentality. Get off my lawn, not in my backyard. We have that so much here. And when Title IX came up, we had a couple members of the board that really pressed hard against it. And in the last board meeting, one of the board members actually had to be convinced that, yes, Title IX is a law. He didn't really know that. And then after saying that it wasn't a law, he quoted a far right wing extremist group when he was talking about the opinion of what Title IX really is. And the reason for all of this is, I call them the Minivan Taliban, Moms for Liberty. It's this group that gained the notoriety from, you know, suing everybody under the sun when we had the audacity to put masks on in schools, you know, because of that whole pandemic thing. And now they've taken their fight to Title IX. And if Pulaski didn't approve this, really the people who would suffer were kids like me who needed help. I didn't get help when I was younger. And I'm not too naive to say, oh, I did it. No, that sucked. I don't want other kids to have to go through that. And where they get those protections is Title IX, because it talks about equality. Equality, whoever you are. Equality based on sexual orientation, sex. Equality for people that have every right to learn the same if you have disabilities. That's what Title IX was. If we didn't pass this, those kids would suffer. And there's a gentleman on the board whose name is Steve. And he just got elected. And he rode this wave of, you know, being this milquetoast candidate who was everything for everyone. Everybody, oh, Steve's brilliant. Steve. And when this debate came up in the big meeting, you know, it was, oh, well, there's concerns. And he didn't talk about his own opinion. And he's, oh, there's concerns. We see these concerns. And every time, everything he was quoting was from the Minivan Taliban of Moms for Liberty saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to have boys going into the girls' bathroom and all these things. And it was just, it was horrible. And so I messaged him on Facebook. I was like, dude, what are you doing? Like, what is your opinion? And he never gave me his opinion. And he never said his opinion in public. And it was like, it's crazy because it's like, dude, you are elected to give your opinion. That is your job. That is your role. And oh boy, did he have an opinion. And he made it known. And then we had a special meeting where all some different community members came in. And I was so disappointed because it was all of these, oh, what if a 400-pound man wants to go to a girl's bathroom and all these different what ifs. And it's crazy because if the people in the community would come into the school, they would realize that these gender neutral bathrooms that they're so scared about, because they see it on Newsmax, because Fox News is too liberal. They see it on Newsmax. These they're already there. Pulaski High School already has these gender neutral bathrooms that they're so scared about. And the dangest thing is the kids don't care. And so these people want to try to put Bibles in schools and religion. And hey, if how about instead of putting Bibles and forcing religion in schools, you all you got to do is live that faith and start treating people like they're equal. Start treating people with kindness. That's what we need to do. And oh, by the way, maybe stop worrying about where 10 commandments are and start worrying about not getting our kids shot in the hallways of their schools. There's so many things that we are kicking around like political footballs. And I'm so disappointed in some of the members of our community and people on our school board. Dennis, Steve, I'm talking to you. We got to do better. We have to do better. And I'm going to talk about it every week here on The Rational Revolution. Thank you for joining us. I am Mark Becker. We'll see you next week.